Big old volume, Jimmy. There you go.
Hey, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening?
Stocks, jocks, stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm tomorrow. Mr. James on the board. We have S&P futures up 34, and NASDAQ futures up 309 as NVIDIA came out, and of course the stock didn't move at all. Actually, it was down after the numbers came out. But then the chairman, just as predicted, came out with some line of stuff. Plus, they're going to buy this company for $12.9 billion, completing, making sure there's going to have a few companies left. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning.
How are you? Do we have anybody that works in the antitrust division, or we given all that up?
No, they're out there.
What do they do all day?
They approve. Well, I mean, DOJ's antitrust group is, I think, examining thousands of transactions. But you know, they spot targets. I think a lot of the antitrust enforcement these days is being left to the plaintiffs bar.
And we're gonna
test this based on that discussion that you and I had last week. We were out in front of that story about those players returning from the NFL, returning to college.
We've been talking about that for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years.
The SEC and Big Ten have decided that they're not going to allow it, and I'll be interested to see how that shakes out. I think an interesting argument could be made that the conferences can set their own eligibility rules. And as long as it's not somebody like the NC2A screaming about it, you can argue that the players will have an opportunity to play football somewhere in college versus particular conferences. So I can see how that argument's going to shape up.
Once this all started, the legal part, you obviously know a lot of, and I'm not so sure I do. And the economic part, it's cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war. Why don't you let the stuff out of the bag? Economically, I mean, I was with a group last night and a couple more attorneys, and we're talking about it a little bit. And I said, when are we gonna figure out that these kids are no longer college students? They're professional players that happen to go to college. And if somebody leaves college for a year to go work for an accounting firm and decides they don't like it and comes back and goes in the MBA program, they can do that anytime they want. If they happen to have a year of eligibility left or two, they can play football. So what's the difference between that and going to work for the Bears and get cut and go back to college and go to the MBA and say, I got a year left? You're already a pro.
Money.
Well, I mean, the NFL is trying to make, and colleges are trying to keep this separate, but economically it's not. It's another pro league. I mean, who's kidding who?
Well, but it's not your pro league. It's their pro league, and the pros in one league are going to move to protect the pros or to protect themselves from the pros in the other league.
Well, what if somebody left the Joliet Jackhammers to go for the Cubs in spring training, he gets cut, you're going to say that he can't go back and play for the Joliet Jackhammers again?
Basically, yeah, you can do that.
Why?
That was that whole live golf versus the PGA dispute.
Well, there's another monopoly that maybe shouldn't be. You know what I'm saying is,
I mean these are voluntary associations of businesses that and
otherwise known as a cartel
or unions that are setting up eligibility requirements for their programs. And unless you can show that there's an anti-competitive effect on, and I think that's where the first fight's going to be, an anti-competitive effect on the SEC saying, look, you know, they can go play college football somewhere, they just can't play it here.
Well, that part, I'm with you. That they can do. That'll last about 5 seconds if six guys end up at Notre Dame and they kick somebody in the SEC's ass.
Well, that'll be an interesting discussion. I see this as another step in the movement towards setting up the group of 64 or 72 or whatever multiple of two we decided on that ultimately plays college football for keepsies. You know, we take the top 64 teams in the U.S., we put them into a league, and then they play each other exclusively. Four 16-team conferences with two divisions in each conference. Those teams play off to a national championship, and everybody else sits on the outside and kind of watches.
Well, that I guess I can understand. But now we have.
I mean, that's what's good. That.
By the way, I'm with you
on that.
We're in total agreement on that. But now, what else comes with it? I mean, I know you and I have always had a little bit of a disagreement regarding. I think the entire setup of Major League Baseball, NFL, and NBA is a total nightmare when it comes to what ought to be in terms of free business. It's a cartel. I mean, and now what's next? Now we're gonna. Are colleges going to be are drafting kids out of high school? Is that going to be okay?
It's going to be something like that, yeah.
Well, that's abysmal. In my mind, that's abysmal.
I agree. You just saw the NFL yesterday also stepped into this mess, saying that if you go back to college, you can't come back to the NFL.
Oh, that'll never fly.
It's already in. It'll be part of.
How did somebody make that?
It'll be an agreement. It'll be an agreement between the teams and the union, and it'll become part of a collective bargaining arrangement.
I know you and I are one of the things we jostle about is, and I know our legal system is verstunken in my mind, but the idea that, so let me get this straight. The Bears cut a guy. They don't want him. He goes back, and nobody else, he won't sign anywhere else. He goes back to college for a year. All of a sudden, he gets better. Then he can never play in the NFL? I mean, that's insanity.
Well, no, they're gonna. It's the season. It's interest season, not interseason. So they can't come back this season. So if they cut a guy, he goes back and plays for his college team. He can't come back to the NFL this season. That's the first announcement.
Okay. So in other words, if somebody gets hurt, you can't grab the guy out of Notre Dame.
Correct.
Well, that makes sense. I think that makes some sort of sense.
So they're well, it really doesn't if you follow the economic rule that you're describing.
Well, I mean, it makes a hair of sense, but because
if you look at the colleges as just the farm teams of the NFL under this new arrangement, then yeah, there ought to be free movement between clubs or between leagues.
That's interesting. They would essentially be the practice squad.
Exactly, an extended practice squad where you're actually staying in shape and actually playing, you know, playing football.
Would you still be under contract?
Who knows?
Well, if you're not,
see, so the draft rights to a kid I think it would depend on whether the kid had been drafted or whether he'd signed just a free agent contract. Draft rights extend in perpetuity. You know, if you are drafted by an NFL club and you decide not to play for them, you go play baseball for a year or two, and then you say, okay, I'm ready to come back and play in the NFL. I'm talking off the top of my head here, but my recollection is that the team that drafted you has the rights to you.
Well, that's what happened with Roger Staubach. He didn't play for 3 years or whatever. He's in the Navy, and he still belonged to the Cowboys.
Yeah,
right?
but that was under the old CBA.
I bet that
hasn't changed. Under the current CBA, I think that's right, though. I think once you're drafted, those rights attach, and no other NFL team can grab you. And so in any event, that a kid coming back and forth between college and the pros, if the kid's drafted, I assume the drafting team would have the exclusive rights to him. If he's a free agent and gets cut, that contract disappears.
Well, I guess you're right. I kind of contradicted myself. If I wander out of Notre Dame as a junior, I got a year, or even a senior, I got a year of eligibility left. I show up at the Bears training camp. I get my ass cut. I go back to play for Notre Dame, and halfway through the year, two starting guards and the Bears get hurt. Why can't I go play for the Bears?
Yeah, I mean it logically, economically,
you probably can't go back to college that semester. But you know, if you don't like the Bears, you can't go back. I mean, somewhere there needs to be a, I don't know where the somewhere is, but why can't you go back? Nobody says you got to play a whole year.
So this is the nightmare that I think these college conferences are trying to prevent. They're trying to protect their players, the guys that they've got coming up, who expect to play. They're trying to protect them. The NFL Players Association, as I said last week, is going to move to protect its players who once they make the roster or are on a practice squad somewhere, have some expectation of at least, you know, remaining there in competition with other people in the league, with this finite set of players in the league or league talent that was available. So this gets really interesting. And as I said, I think this is going to – two things happen. The antitrust rules, as you've noted, will apply on these player restrictions and these movement restrictions. That's already been established.
Well, as long as you don't get senators and presidents involved.
Well, no, the antitrust rules will apply whether they get involved or not. Now, once – The way around that, the traditional way around that, is to do a form what's called a multi-employer bargaining unit, which enters into a union contract with a bunch of unionized employees across multiple companies, and you write a collective bargaining agreement that deals with the movement of these employees between the companies. And once you do that, you can you know, collude and fix pricing and fix eligibility and all that, because it's a labor contract that's been collectively bargained. And that's the fundamental basis for, I mean, that was the reason you brought me on the show back in 2011, yeah. Tom.
Well, many reasons. You talk about more than that. What is the nature? Boy, I've never seen one. If I'm a free agent and I sign on with the Bears, what is the nature of that contract? And if I'm in today's world, if I play for Notre Dame or Illinois or somebody, what is the nature of that contract? And how many contracts do I have? Do I have one with Notre Dame? Do I have one with George's Jackie Shorts? Do I have one? How many do I have? And does the contract I sign with Notre Dame or Jackie Shorts make me play the whole season at Notre Dame if they're going to pay me?
It could. Yeah, you sign an NIL agreement that says you're going to exclude, and these agreements do say this, that say you are exclusively playing for this school for this season or for X number of seasons. And if you leave, you've got to pay back whatever NIL advancement was made. That's given. In the NFL, it's a little different. A portion of your money is guaranteed and paid to you up front. And then a significant portion of it is not. And that those contracts can be voided at any time.
Well, I'm talking about what if I show up at the Bears training camp and said, hey, everybody forgot about me, but I'm a guard, and they let me go to training camp. Now, what does that contract look like?
It depends. If you're a draftee or a draft.
No, you're drafted, not a draftee. You're no.
Okay, you're a free agent. Okay, yeah. So you're a undrafted free agent. That contract, you sign a contract to play football exclusively for that NFL club, and it's a standard player contract. It can be, as I said, it can be voided.
When I just get training camp money, and if I make the team, then something else happens. But if I don't, I'm just gone.
Right. Once you make the roster, I mean, it lays all that out.
But once I'm cut, that thing's void.
Yes, if the team cuts you, correct.
So I could go, a buddy of mine is with the Cleveland Browns and says, oh, hey, we need a guard over here. I can immediately go the next day to Cleveland, or I could go to Illinois. I mean,
right.
I go somewhere.
Well, okay. So when you're cut, you go into. You go into something called the waiver system. You remember the old waiver wire?
Yeah.
You go into the waiver system. Teams have there's a stacked order of preference as to which teams can sign you.
I never was drafted by anybody. Why do I have to go into that?
Well, you're not drafted, but you're signed. You're signed to a contract.
Okay.
Once you come in, there's an order as to what. Which team you're signed by a team, you become that team's property.
So after one day of wind sprints, they go, this guy sucks, and they cut me. They still sort of own me.
They don't own you, but the rights to you pass into this staggered waiver system that the NFL's established again to try to keep competition clean. So the worst teams have an option of taking you before the best teams do.
What if I don't want to go there?
You're out of luck.
So let me get this straight. They never paid me hardly a dime. They told me they didn't want my ass, yet somehow or another, I have to go now to the Titans. That's insane.
The Titans have first crack at you when you're cut like that, yes.
But I don't want to go to the Titans. I want to go to the Browns.
Yeah, well, welcome to the NFL.
Sounds like kind of a one-sided deal, doesn't it?
It's the same. It's a variation of the draft system, Tom, which restricts the rights of players to move.
Well, that's what I'm so
dead set. Want to go.
So, all right. So I come out of law school and I go to Lou, and Lou. We don't like this guy. We cut him. Oh no! By the way, you can only go to Rybczynski Law first. I don't want to go to Rybczynski.
The economic motivations, as you know, are completely different for a bunch of lawyers scrabbling around out in the dirt versus highly selective NFL level players. The league, the practice of law and the economics of law and the benefit or the value of your law firm does not depend on the competitiveness of other law firms or the value of other law firms. In an athletic league, the value of your team is directly dependent on the value of the other teams and the competitiveness of the other teams. So it's in your interest to maintain the competitiveness of your opponents.
Sounds like a cartel to me.
It's communism.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that would be the term.
In every way, shape, oh yeah, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. The NFL looks around and says, okay, if you've got a lousy record, you have more needs than the team that had the better record. So to each according to his needs, and we expect everybody to play at the top of their game, but the losers every year get an advantage, a competitive advantage, so that they maintain their competitiveness.
Well, because the idea that I mean, baseball is the worst because they have like 90 zillion rounds. team is never going to. You could show up at a team and they got 15 shortstops. You never get to go to another team that has none. That's insane. I mean, maybe if they're that largesse, they may trade you. But boy, that's interesting. I mean, this whole thing sucks, Lou. I mean, I think it could be a lot freer, and you know what? It'd be just as competitive.
No.
You think it's necessary?
Do you think Major League? Because let's just look at the two leagues, baseball and football. Do you think that Major League Baseball across the board is as competitive as the NFL in terms of the ability of teams to compete against each other and to be successful?
Well, no, because I think in a lot of ways the NFL has 7 rounds. Major League Baseball has like 30. It's a huge difference.
But the main difference is that there's a hard salary cap for the NFL teams. They can't spend more than a set amount of money on their rosters.
I don't think that in my opinion that's even worse. Okay, but
baseball. I know. Oh, I know. Yeah, baseball has a very soft salary cap, with the end result that teams like the Dodgers or the Yankees or other well-financed clubs can outspend the other teams, and you have traditional winners and traditional losers, and there's not a lot of movement between those groups.
Okay, but when we talk back, you're not the only one. Whenever I talk to people regarding baseball, they immediately jump to the major league level, the arbitration, the free agency, and those kind of stuff. And my point always has been, that's 1/400th of the people. The other people are essentially in a slave camp. You can't go anywhere. I'm worried about the guy in the A-League that realizes his team has 15 catchers and somebody else has none and he can't move. And the idea that he was in the 28th round, all he is fodder for that team someplace and he can't go somewhere else. Football has made, I think, within the cartel arrangement, has made pretty dramatic advances with the idea that you only have 7 people, 7 rounds. What if they drafted like everybody, like baseball does, and they own everybody? I mean, that's even more bizarre. At least in football, if you're not somebody they really want, you get a chance essentially to pick your own team and go try out if you want. So in that regard, it's way more free than baseball, I think.
Yeah, there's 300, whatever it is, 300 guys per year that get less drafted.
Than that. How many teams?
Yeah,
are there?
It is. I'm just rounding.
Well, I mean, there's 30 teams, right? Or 32.
32 teams, 7 rounds. Seven. But there's extra draft picks thrown in and out of there.
Okay.
So it's
250.
Rounds up a little. But yeah, typically it's right around. I think it's 270 something was.
Yeah, but baseball's 900.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So the question. So here's another interesting question, and I'll throw this out. Does the NFL draft get bigger because of the rules that are coming in with respect to the eligibility of college players?
I don't want anybody owning anybody. You know.
But anyway, I want to raise something that just happened yesterday or 2 days ago that I want to flag for you and your investor audience. So this is an interesting discussion, the player eligibility. It's gonna shake out here over the next year, but I expect to see the players associations get heavily involved in this with the clubs, at every level, MLB, NFL, NHL, NBA. It's all gonna start shaking the tree. The issue that I wanted to point out was, and I don't know if you guys talked about it yesterday, was the visit to Moscow by the head of the USCIA.
And I was waiting for you to come on to do that because I have no idea what that means.
Okay. So we flew, I first became aware of this when I was looking at Twitter and it flags stuff for me, and this story popped up that a US C-17 cargo plane was flying along with a couple of other aircraft, was flying into Moscow directly. And I went, well, what?
Yeah, I saw that too. So, but I didn't know what to make of it.
So that got my attention right away. It then turns out they leak this story that the head of the CIA is going directly to Moscow to talk to either Vladimir Putin directly or his Soviet FSB counterpart, a Russian FSB counterpart. So I, at that point, you know, my ears are up. I'm going, whoa, this is highly unusual. The U.S. government leaked yesterday.
Back up here. Have you ever, boy, we're not kids anymore. Have you ever heard of this, the head of the CIA having any kind of mission like that before?
I've heard rumors of those kind of contacts, but never face to face like this.
I mean, don't we have an? Do we still have an ambassador there? We got a Secretary of State.
We do. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Why can't? Isn't that their job?
It would be normally, yes.
All right. So keep going. Keep going. Sorry.
So now, so, and the Russians were not talking about this at all.
Were they? Were they he was invited, or they just showed up, or they said? I mean, how do you think it started out?
I think it started out with somebody picking the phone up in the White House and calling the Russian counterpart and saying, we have a very important message to deliver to you. It's got to be done face to face. We're going to send Mr. what's his name, the head of the CIA, in.
Would you have any idea why you would pick him?
We want an audience. Well, yeah, I do know why they picked him. So we want an audience. And we're, this is something that probably could have been done, maybe should have been done in 2022 before the Russians invaded Ukraine. But the CIA head went in, we leaked to the press what was going on. First thing we leaked was that our aircraft was inbound. The second thing we got leaked out was that it was the head of the CIA. The third thing that got leaked out was why.
They got the message that the aircraft was inbound and didn't shoot it down.
Oh yeah, no, that would have all been arranged. The first, well, and then other interesting stories leaked out. The one of them, in advance of the actual purpose of the visit, was that we had told the Ukrainians that they were not to attack Moscow over a 3-day period. While our guy was there.
Yeah, we didn't want him landing it on our guy's head. Okay.
The second thing that happened was we asked the Russians to not attack Kiev during that same period. And the Russians said, okay. And then our guy, then the CIA head went in. The message he delivered was very straightforward, and it was this. Our intelligence assets have detected a buildup of Russian forces in certain areas in anticipation or in preparation for what we believe you guys are going to do to test NATO resolve. And we believe, based on what we're seeing, that you're going to go into probably a Baltic state and you're going to make a land invasion into one of the Baltics to try to push NATO and see how far NATO is willing to go. And we're telling you that that would be a really big mistake. Just so you don't have to guess at whether we will defend NATO, if you do that, we're coming in. And oh, by the way,
what does coming in mean?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't specify a direct result, but this mirrors military activity by NATO around the Russian enclave in Kaliningrad, which is a chunk of land that is between, I believe it's Estonia, I think that's the southernmost Baltic state, Estonia and Poland. And it's held over from World War II. It used to be Königsberg in Germany, but it was occupied by the Russians, and they held on to it after the Second World War. It's heavily fortified, but it's definitely there, and they use it as a springboard into the Baltic. We had military aircraft, surveillance, and some other very sophisticated aircraft.
I've been reading about that for like a month now.
That were up around Kaliningrad for a couple of days, basically running around the outside of it and effectively demonstrating, look.
That's what you used to do, right? sort of.
That's exactly, something like that, yeah. Effectively demonstrating that we know what's going on there. And that if you decide, and I assume the message was blunt, it was a very short meeting, but it was delivered very bluntly and directly, saying, if you do this, it's war, and we will attack you. There will be consequences. We could wipe Kaliningrad off the map. We could destroy your forces there and kick you out if you decide you're going to come in. Plus, we're going to defend Estonia. And oh, by the way, if you come in, if you decide to make this kind of a test of resolve, we're not guaranteeing we don't go into Russia, because we have all kinds of common border areas where we could drive straight across, and we could turn the Finns loose on you, we could turn the Swedes loose on you, and you know,
who's we? Is it NATO or Trump?
NATO.
So we're back in with NATO, basically.
Well, we've always been with NATO.
Okay, all right. I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I hope so.
I mean, all this swagger, all the bluster, and Trump was right. I think Trump was absolutely right to do it. But all of that was aimed at getting the Europeans off their butts, and to a certain extent, it's worked. Getting the Europeans off their butts to start getting ready for their own defense, because our intel has showed this was a possibility of Russian aggression into NATO was a possibility for years.
All right, I've got three really solid questions that, I hope you, I don't know how you can answer them in less than a day, but what is, I have to believe after all of this, and I would agree that in Trump's first term, he shook those guys up, and I actually think Biden kept that up a little bit. I think NATO is, the European places are in better shape than they were 6 years ago, don't you?
They definitely are, but...
You know, whose fault it was and who's got it started, whatever. The fact is, I think they are. They're a little more ready than they were 6 years ago. I mean, I can't put a finger, but
the irony is, the real wild card of that whole thing is Canada. Canada sucks. They've had steadfastly, I mean, they make noises about, we're going to do this, but they've steadfastly refused to increase their defense spending in any meaningful way.
Well, I can ask you, because you're the guy who speaks Russian. What is Russia, or Putin, I'll say, because I think he's losing it mentally, if he ever had it. What is his view of their capabilities? What's his view currently of our capabilities? Because obviously we're a little weaker with the Iran thing, but I don't know, but in terms of a land war in Europe, I don't know if we're that much weaker. I mean, what do you think his view of his capabilities, because I don't see him being so hot unless he's going to borrow people from North Korea again. What do you think his view of our capabilities are? Do you have any idea?
I think they've got a reasonably good view of our military's capabilities and what we can do. I mean, we've demonstrated it over and over again the last, you know, last decade.
Well, we've demonstrated that in a 4-week war, you don't want to mess with us. I'm not so sure we've demonstrated that we have enough stuff now to be two fronts. I mean, I don't know what my read of that is. What do you think his is the question?
Here's his read. You remember we talked about this. We've talked about this before. Deterrence, deterring the Russians in Europe, and deterrence is the purpose of NATO. And deterrence is comprised of two elements. One is the material capability to inflict unacceptable damage on your opponent. And two is the will to use that material capability. And I don't think Putin believes that, and this was why the visit was very important, I don't think Putin believes we have the will. He certainly looks at Germany, which has you know, basically poured gasoline on itself and set itself on fire. I think he looks at Germany and maybe France and some of the other major players, certainly the UK, and says the minute you try to get your armed forces engaged, you're going to have, you know, a 10,000 people protesting outside the gates of every one of your military installations, and we, the Russians, can shut all that down. Because we have agents there, we'll mobilize your Muslim populations to protest. We'll do all of that, and we can preclude you from moving. I think that's the way they look at it.
I would agree. I'll use the term pissed off. It's some of the cross currents, Lou. I mean, because, by the way, you may not think that I pretty much remember every one of our shows, you and I. I mean, you were the one that came on and said when this thing with Ukraine started how it was affecting Russian transportation and, you know, roller bearings, and we had a whole list of stuff. And now here it is 4 years later, and somehow the Russians are buying this crap. They seem to be getting it from someplace. And we have an administration, I'm not saying the Biden guys are any, that you can't write a check to me for $10 without somebody's nose all over it. And yet we have an administration and the one before that seem to love this Bitcoin crap. And by the way, are all invested in it. And it looks to me like that's the mechanism for all these illegal activities. How can we be doing both of these things? I mean, somehow or another, the Federal Reserve, you and I, if they blocked our checkbook, you and I would have to go live under a bridge. They come after us that hard. Yet somehow or another, this money just flies from place to place as if none of these things are even... How does this all happen?
To go back to the original point, the Russians believe that they could push into NATO. They could make a move to reestablish the empire, the Soviet Empire, and do so at a minimal cost from NATO. I mean, that is apparently what they think. And they're going to test that by some kind of ground attack or ground invasion, incursion into the Baltics. That's what we were afraid of. And we wanted to make sure that the Russians knew that if you do that, you may find yourself in a shooting war that you can't control.
Isn't that every war?
No. I think we believe we could control it. I'm pretty sure we wanted to convince them that listen, if you do that and we come across, we're not going to hold ourselves to fighting strictly defensively. If we come across your frontier, we're not going to drive it across the kind of prepared ground that you see in Ukraine where those tank attacks that they tried to do 3 years ago fell apart because of the defense in depth. Your border doesn't look like that. We could come straight across into the Kola Peninsula from Finland.
Oh, we could come from Japan.
We could drive in a whole variety of ways. And inflict, you know, you're losing some refineries right now to the Ukrainians. You know, you won't be able to drive a car 100 meters.
Okay, but I guess the question I'm asking you, because I don't know what is their view? They think this isn't Czechoslovakia when I was a kid. I mean, they think they're going to roll a bunch of tanks. Do they even have tanks? I mean, obviously, where are they going to get enough tanks? Isn't every tank they've got somewhere buried in Ukraine? Somehow they think they're going to roll 1,000 tanks and 300,000 guys across Estonia, take the place where they got their drawers down, and by the time the Germans and we and everybody else can get there, then what? They plan on just keeping it like forever and everything's okay.
Yeah, they plan on fortifying it and holding it, and then
just like forever. And everybody's just supposed to forget it.
And then they would effectively extort the rest of NATO to start buying their gas again, and to deal with them more favorably.
Boy, that's
lift the sanctions. They would say, "Look, your American friends are a paper tiger. We're the real tiger, we're on your doorstep."
If you were advising Putin, you'd say, "Boy, that's a hopeful story on your part, buddy."
Do you think that Mr. Putin is taking stock of things in the way you and I see him? Remember when he invaded Ukraine?
Yeah, we've had this discussion before, but
that's
whenever you do something, I mean, that's what I kind of criticize. Well, hell, I sure criticize Vietnam. What are we doing there? What's the end game? What do we plan on doing?
The end game is the reestablishment of the Soviet Empire with a buffer zone across Eastern Europe. That's the end game.
Yeah, but the dude's losing one war right now. How many more does he want?
The Russians understand. The Russians believe they're winning in Ukraine, and to a certain extent they are. And I mean, they've stalemated. The Ukrainians have stalemated the advance, admittedly, but for right now, the Russians have said, okay, fine. We can absorb. We're Russia. We can absorb an infinite amount of punishment, and we're going to prove it to you. And while the Ukrainians are chipping away and, you know, hitting an occasional gas refinery or some wild berries warehouse in the suburbs of Moscow, we're going to rain ballistic missiles down on their, you know, down on their capital, which is what they're doing right now, and other facilities. And basically, we're going to bleed them dry because we've got 150 million people that we can draw on for soldiers, for battlefield casualties. They've lost. I mean the numbers just keep getting worse. They've lost, you know, the estimates I'm saying now are somewhere in the 300,000 to 400,000 killed, and four times that wounded.
Yeah, don't these people have family? I mean, how is there no pushback, Lou?
They do, but this is again, I told you from the beginning that the average Russian is absolutely convinced that this is the right move, that they need to bring Ukraine back into Russia, that Ukraine was originally part of Russia, and that it's been occupied by, what was the term that we had early on, Nazi homosexual drug dealers. That's how the Russians characterize them and their leadership. So there's
everything
not
in the eye of the beholder, as they say.
He is not facing the kind of domestic pressure that we would be looking at. I mean, look at the pressure Trump's under, and we're winning in Iran.
We're not winning in the sense that how he defined it in the first day.
Agreed. You know, I'm not going to say that we're not. It's not happening the way he wanted it to happen, but I mean, if you see the stuff that's coming out of Iran right now, it's pretty bleak.
Sure it is. I mean, I look at this from an economic standpoint, and you're right. I look at it that way; it makes no sense, but it clearly can make sense in Putin's mind.
I'm going to move from this sort of strategic overview down to something more direct in terms of products and investments. The Navy earlier this week, have you guys talked about the Malice, MALICE system?
No, but I do have a question for you regarding, because you're the one who brought it up. Can I steal 2 minutes here?
Go.
You were the one that talked about all these combinations and so forth in the defense industry, and you also said that on the bottom end there's some pretty good competition, which, by the way, is terrific news. But on the top end, it appears there's like none. There's only like one or two people that are going to make planes for you. I listened to this thing on YouTube regarding these aircraft carriers. You know, we're supposed to have 11 of them, and evidently, you learn every day doing the show. That's why I like doing it. I never realized there was a connection between the refit and the new ones in terms of scheduling. That mm-hmm. when you bring one of the Nimitz class in for its 25-year refueling and refitting, it's a 3-year procedure.
Right, it's a long time.
It's a long time, but you bring it back essentially into the same place as where you're building a new one. And there's only like one or two dry docks can handle these things, the kind of dry docks they need, and it's the same people. I mean, I had no idea that a guy who was a welder for a nuclear thing is like a 5-year process. It's not just teaching a guy how to weld, a railroad car. It's a big deal, and all these people that are a group of, let's say, people that can design and work and weld and all that kind of crap, is not that big. So. And the Kennedy is a little late, and the new one, whatever, whether it's named after Trump or whoever, they have these people working on it. But this guy traced this, and I forget the names of them a little bit. The first one that came in evidently was the Stennis, like 5 years ago or something, or 4 6 years ago. It came in for its 25 year, and it somehow or another, I don't know if they had a work problem or whatever they did, it was another 6 months to a year before they kicked it back out. Well, in the meantime, the Ford was being delayed as well. So now the place is jammed up with the first new one, the next new one, and one they're redoing, because they don't have spots for like five of them. So if the Stennis is 6 months to a year late, well, that meant the Kennedy was 6 months to a year late, or the Ford, and now you're behind on the Kennedy, and then now you're bringing the next one in back behind the Stennis. Now that's out 26 years instead of 25. So now it's behind, and there's no other place to go. You're going to Newport News Shipping. You're not going to Oakland or someplace. There's nobody else can do it. I mean, is this guy right? It sounded to me, I'm sure Kevin being a supply chain guy, it sounds exactly like what sort of is happening, is it? One is just piling up on top of the next one, on top of the next one.
So the guys that write about naval capabilities on in the defense news have been talking about this for over a decade, that the loss of capability in our ship refurbishing.
Did we ever have two places where nuclear aircraft carriers were either built? I doubt if we ever had two Newport Newses, did we?
We did. We had several. We had,
really?
So you got Newport News. You've got.
I thought every
Long Beach.
I thought every single aircraft carrier right now is built in the same spot.
I think every single aircraft carrier is, but the repair and refurbishment facilities were on. There was a West Coast version, and I want to say it was Long Beach, but I don't know for sure. And then we had shipyards on the East Coast that could handle it. Philadelphia was one.
They could handle the whole 3 year nuclear thing. This made it sound like there's no way that Long Beach has 50 nuclear welders that are whatever licensed to do that kind of crap.
I don't have that kind of granular familiarity with it. I've just been reading in terms of the actual ship types.
Okay, I get
that
it.
Could be refurbished, but I do know that those yards on the West Coast and the East Coast that have shut down had tremendous capability and capacity that's gone now.
So they could deal with like the rest of the ships, even if it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah, they took the pressure off. They took the pressure off those that Newport News and the other place in.
Did you happen
in
to listen to Hal on Tuesday? He was on the Truxton, which was an old nuclear, seemed like a small cruiser, a big destroyer, or whatever. And he was telling me he's been telling all the listeners about his last out there when he was, however many days he was in the Persian Gulf and all this stuff and how the thing was designed, because I'm reading all about the ship, and it was designed for 31 knots. And Hal's like, we couldn't make over 10. The thing was, I said, so how, you couldn't keep up with a battle group? He goes, we were supposed to be in a battle group. The couple times I went up top, I never saw another ship. He goes, basically, we were in line to get hit by the missile before the aircraft carrier, like 30 miles away, because nobody cared if we could move.
How could something
that's supposed to be designed at 31 knots be kicking around at 8 or 10 out in the ocean?
That's why they were coming to the end of their life, and that's one of the reasons why the current leadership is pushing this battleship idea, which I don't think is necessarily a bad idea if we were able to field something like that. All right, real quick. New product line, the Malice system. So the Navy announced the deployment or development, I think it's ready to be deployed, of a new air-to-air missile. And this has been something that your listeners have heard me talk about before.
So you mean you're talking plane-to-plane?
Plane-to-plane. So we have been at a significant disadvantage vis-a-vis Russian and Chinese aircraft with regard to missile capability for probably the last decade.
Why? Ours are just old and they got new ones?
Because we have a basic missile called the AMRAAM, the Advanced Medium Range Air-to-Air Missile. It's a sort of a very capable system, but its range is limited to, probably reliably somewhere between 50 and 60 miles. That's the Russians and the Chinese have deployed systems that are capable out to over 100, which means their guys can shoot way before we can. if they can see us.
So they could go knock out an AWACS from 100 miles away.
Yep, that's what those things were designed to do. So this has been an issue, and we've rolled out a series of improvements to AMRAAM that have given an extended range, supposedly of over 120 miles, but it's not really that kind of a capability. It was never designed to have that kind of capability.
So, quick question: can the Chinese guide that thing for 100 miles without having an AWACS?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's an air-to-air missile. They can identify a target at 100 miles, put targeting data into the missile, and then fire it, and really have a reasonably good chance of hitting its target.
So they don't need it to be guided like by an AWACS or something. They can do it itself.
Either the aircraft does it themselves or the AWACS does it. So we rolled out earlier this week, the Navy rolled out something called the MALIS missile, the AIM, Air Intercept Missile, that's the acronym, AIM, 464, I believe is the designation. And so the AMRAAM is the AIM 120, the MALIS is the AIM 464. It has a range of 250 nautical miles, supposedly. I mean,
At high speed?
At Mach 5.
Wow. How big is it? Jesus.
And here's the real interesting stage, the interesting thing. It's designed to fit inside the bay of an F-35 or F-22.
Wow.
Which means it can be carried internally, and they remain stealthy. So you have...
If you hang it outside, you lose your stealth, I take
right,
it.
Right. Okay. Right. So the key point for... the listeners is this is a really interesting move that we've rolled this missile out, and it gives you a lot of insight into how we think we're going to end up fighting the next, if we have to fight the Chinese or somebody like them, a peer adversary. It gives you some real insight into where our targeting and target selection is going, and that we're going to be shooting at targets, 200 miles away.
Who made this?
I think it's Raytheon.
Okay.
But this thing is a beast, and it represents just a quantum jump, and I mean that deliberately.
So you drop it like a bomb, and then it takes off.
It falls out of the bay
of the
fighter and ignites and then climbs. And it'll fly itself up to 120, 130,000 feet, and where it can maintain that Mach 5 speed, and it cruises up there for a while, and then it comes down onto the target.
Wow. That's interesting. How that would have to be. I mean, you're not going to do that with Russia, because that would be like over water, right?
I mean, it's obviously designed to engage extended ranges, but against Russia, it would be aimed at their airborne warning aircraft. Their airborne radar aircraft, their AWACS.
Okay.
Same for China. It would also be aimed at any kind.
Ukrainians knock out a bunch of those in one of their first sales?
Yeah, they did. They did. They did it with drones while the things were parked, and in one case we think they shot it down with a Patriot, shot another one down with a Patriot.
Wow.
But in any event, just a heads up on that, and I see Wayne is in the wings, and it's after 6, so I'm going to check off.
What's the story? I was watching the Lake Powell Lake Mead thing, and I was thinking about you. What's going on over there? You guys get it?
We got some rain here yesterday, but not enough. We need lots more.
What is the El Nino snowpack prediction?
It's supposed to be really snowy in the Pacific Northwest and in the southwest areas of Colorado. I've just seen the Colorado forecast. It might get to us here in Denver, but it's supposed to be average to above average snowpack this winter.
You guys could need it. You guys could need it. All right, buddy.
All right.
All right, SP Futures up 32, NASDAQ Futures up 266. Big news is NVIDIA is up 1287 after being down yesterday, but you got to be... Every time that guy talks, he manages to talk the thing up. Do we have Professors Wayne and Andrew?
Well, you've got me here.
Well, there you go.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
What did you think of all the stuff that Lou and I were talking about?
I have similar questions about the flight to Moscow. They use one of these... Globemaster planes to fly Ratcliffe, the CIA director, and a bunch of vehicles. So what they do is they land at the airport. There's two major airports. I don't know which one they actually landed.
Name the two, and I'll tell you.
Vnukovo and Sheremetyevo, I think, is the,
Was one outside of town, I think, because they did a drive-by.
Yeah, yeah, that's the big international one, Sheremetyevo. But here they roll the motorcade off of this Globemaster, and they're traveling with the flags and the American flags through downtown traffic in Moscow. I just wonder what these people, there were a couple of people had their GoPro cameras on, Russians posted the video later. You got to wonder what they were thinking, you know? I mean,
what would we think if we saw a bunch of Russian flags driving down State Street? I don't know. What would you think?
Yeah, or in Pennsylvania Avenue heading to the White House. But now that might be believable. You know, people would say, oh, he's finally turned us over to Russia. But on the issue with the Baltic states, it's actually Kaliningrad is surrounded by Poland and Lithuania, and there's a thing called the Suwalki Gap, which is a 65-kilometer small strip of land that connects Poland to Lithuania. On the other side is Kaliningrad. On the western side of that is Belarus, which is for all
Who has the coastline?
The coastline is shared between Kaliningrad and Lithuania, and there's a spit of land that they both share on the Baltic, and it's low-level marshland, I think that if, in fact, the Ratcliffe issued a démarche, as they call it in the diplomatic world, don't move on NATO, but they already have been. They've been started with interfering with GPS, then they started flying drones over NATO territory, and then there was this attempt to blow up a Ukrainian a cargo plane in Germany, and it of course was foiled by German intelligence. The Russians have been blowing up factories that produce ammunition in the Czech Republic, in Bulgaria, and most recently in Italy. So they've already been making their moves. I think Ratcliffe and the Russians know this. If we're out of ammunition to use against Iran, we're also out of ammunition to use potentially against Russia, and I think Putin knows that, and now is probably the best time he would have ever had to go make a move against NATO.
Where's he going to get them? Lou claims he doesn't care. He thinks differently, but yeah. Go ahead.
Right, he's going to full mobilization, ostensibly against Ukraine, but full mobilization. That all the reserves are called up.
Where's he getting the dough?
he's getting a lot of. He's one of the richest guys in the world himself.
Well, he is. Yeah, I get that.
I'm sure he's shaking down these Russian oligarchs for money too to finance his military efforts.
Lou constantly is smacking me upside the head, and rightfully so, because I can't think that other people think the way I do. But boy, if I'm up to my eyeballs in Ukraine, the last thing I would want to do is start another war. I mean, for God's sake.
I hope he makes a move. I hope Putin does try something, because I've one of my more recent books is about these nations in waiting that lie within in Russia. They were grabbed by the Russians, going back to the Tsars, and I've counted well over 85 of these captive nations inside the so-called Russian Federation, which I've always maintained is neither Russian nor a true federation.
You're talking about all the different languages and all the different people that live there.
It's different languages, different religions, different cultures. You've got in Asia, you got the Mongol type Buddhist republics. Up in the north, you got the what they call the Finno-Ugric republics, also in the middle of Russia. Then you got the Turkic republics, places like Tatarstan, which is a major producer of Russian weapon systems, and the Ukrainians have been hitting those factories there to try to cripple that effort. Turkey knows full well that if Russia implodes, they've got easy pickings on these Turkic republics inside Russia. So, not to mention the fact you got trapped, I call them trapped Ukrainians from Stalin's deportations. You got Ukrainian communities all throughout the Russian Federation just waiting for that signal.
Well, that's why I keep asking Lou, because he's our man who listens to Russian TV, what could possibly be going through Putin's mind? Okay, so he sneaks up on everybody, which he probably can't. I mean, obviously he can't, because we already warned him.
Yeah.
Or he blows through Estonia and he makes it in 300 miles. But he thinks everybody's going to go away? I mean, what does he think happens?
No. It's thought if he makes a move on NATO, it would be this town, this city called Narva, which is on the Estonian-Russian border. The people in Narva largely are Russian speakers, but Estonia has been pretty good about trying to extend full citizenship to the Russian speakers. You got to learn Estonian, for one thing. You better not be caught doing anything on the side with the Russians, because that's a good way to get charged with espionage and expelled. But by and large, the standard of living in Estonia is far greater than on the other side of the Narva River in Russia. And if he makes that move, he's going to be facing Finland from the north. It's a short hop from Tallinn, Estonia, by ferry over to Helsinki. And of course, the Finns would like to go. They have an old beef axe to grind with Russia. Remember when Stalin invaded Finland in the Winter War? The Finns gave him a run for his money, and basically that war, when there was an armistice, it was sort of a standoff. But the Finns took out a lot of guys in the Red Army, because it was called the White Death. The Finns would wear these white, they were on skis, and they'd wear these white outfits, and the Russians never saw them coming.
Well, it seems like the money flying around is always something that Putin's view of the world, again, is the guy going senile or what? I mean,
I think we have two guys that are senile, and they're sitting on top of the greatest arsenal of nuclear weapons the planet's ever seen. So that'll make you sleep well at night.
What do you think the capability is? I mean, where's Lou in here? Maybe Andrew can help us out. There is a certain amount of maintenance to your nuclear arsenal. Don't you have to replace the exploders or the caps or something like every few years? I mean, do you think Russia's, first of all, I don't know, I hope we do. Do you think those guys have been able to keep, I read something on Quora the other day. So what if the Russian gave a full-out nuclear attack to us? What would happen? And the guy went through, God, I forget the numbers now, something like they have 1,800 nuclear weapons, allegedly, probably 1,200 of them could move, and then out of those, most of them are just one, they don't have six things on them like ours, and the first places they got to go is they're going to have to go after our nuclear sites. I mean, they're not going to come after us. So there's another 300. So the guy basically worked its way down to, even though it was a full assault, we would survive. We wouldn't be happy, and a lot of people would be dead. But, it seems like just to do that, do you have these things manned by people? Are they up? Could they run tomorrow? I mean, does anybody have any idea what their capabilities in that place is? I mean, same or with us. I have a feeling, I hope ours, if we needed them, hope we never do, would actually fire. I mean, I don't know. Do you think theirs would?
I would hope so. But, one thing Elon Musk did is I remember when he fired a bunch of people at the Nuclear Safety Administration, that's the group that monitors our nukes. And we don't know how many people got hand at the CIA and NSA that monitor the Russian.
What is the
news.
But
anyway, I'm talking too much, Andy. I know.
Well, something I was asking Andrew.
When's
the last time? And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. It could very well be the right guy. I don't think I've ever seen the CIA director being the lead on a message like this. Is that just me not knowing, or I mean, why him? I guess is the question.
Joe Biden sent his CIA director William Burns over to Moscow.
Okay, so it's not
in a military. He took the normal, government executive jet over there, but he's the guy that said, "Hey, look, we know it looks like you're getting ready to invade Ukraine. This is 21," and Burns went over there.
So it's not that unprecedented. It's just
no.
So I mean, I just was kind of stunned it wasn't the Secretary of State or somebody like that. I don't know. I just. So I'll be unstunned. I'll unstun myself. It's okay. Well, you know, I didn't think it was anything wrong with it. It just seemed a little unusual, and you're saying it's not. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Andrew, what's your comment on all this mess?
Well, first, I'm so impressed with the expertise and the good questions. That's why I've been silent. Between Wayne and Lou, there's a lot of knowledge that's you're putting on the program. I'll just add something about Wayne. You know, he's rattling off all these names of these places, and I'll just point out that my recollection is Wayne was stationed in Finland when he was in Navy intelligence, so that's partly where this comes from. And also the name of his book that he mentioned in passing, I've got it right here, A Parade of New Sovereignties, and he just updated that, and it's basically a page of over 400 entities that he described a few moments ago, and it's the basic information about where they are, what their would-be flag is, and what the likelihood of that they'll ever be an actual country, and some are down around 10%. Many are because they're all contained in larger entities like the quote-unquote Russian Federation. But just a last quick point about this is that a lot of these entities within the Russian Federation are disproportionately supplying draftees to, or others, maybe volunteers, for the Ukraine war and getting killed, with the concept that, well, they're out in the boondocks, they have no way of really protesting all these deaths. And that, of course, feeds frustration that of the kind Wayne was referencing. And since a lot of the, I know a lot of great focus on the show on supply systems, a lot of the supplies are coming from North Korea and China to fund the Russian war efforts, and those are very vulnerable through rail lines to kind of sabotage as they pass through these.
Is there the rail line areas between? Wasn't there a new one, or I don't know, was the first one? The rail line from China into Russia, was that ever finished?
I don't think it was finished to the extent that was wanted, because obviously this would be just a fantastic supply portal for both countries. I don't have current information on it, but I don't think it's what it was hoped to be, just simply because of the distractions of an ongoing war effort by Russia.
When you say there's 80 different groups, I'm sure it's all going to take you at your word, but what, I guess the question that pops into my head, and I don't want to ask it, is how many of those are like self-sustaining? I mean, I look at Chicago, for instance, and okay, then if I go back 40 years, you know, all the Polish people lived up on the Northwest Side. It's a, kind of their own community. The German people live in this one area. The Irish people, well, there was two factions, North and South, but they're all down in, you know, Bridgeport and Mount Greenwood, those kinds of areas. And the Lithuanians are all in Market. I mean, they're all, I guess you could call them their own sort of communities, but yeah, each one of them couldn't be a city. I mean, you sort of have to, I mean, it does one, every one of the 80 different areas, I mean, could the Mongol group, could they be their own country? Do they have a rail line? Do they have an airport? How much would be, you know, like when Yugoslavia fell apart, it kind of dropped into the three places or four places it was beforehand. But what if Russia just tomorrow, all of a sudden they were gone, an asteroid landed on Lenin Square or something, how many of these places could actually be countries?
Well, the major problem is most of them are landlocked.
That's what I thought. Okay,
but in some cases, these landlocked entities, take for example Tatarstan, which is like the arms making. It's called the Republic, but Putin has basically emaciated the rights of the ethnic republics within Russia. And that was something that was a right granted to them by Lenin when the Soviet Union was first formed. In the case of Tatarstan, which has all these munitions factories, one of the other, it also borders on another Turkic republic called Bashkortostan. And the Bashkirs who live there are providing troops to the Ukrainian government. Of course, this is all without Moscow's agreement. But their Bashkir exile groups have joined the Ukrainian forces in an international league and have been roughing up the Russians pretty well. Same thing with Chechnya. And now the Chechen leader, Kadyrov, he used to be a warlord who fought Russia, but he did a deal with the Russians. Hey, we'll put you in charge. You just look out for Russian interests and also send Chechen, what they call Chechen National Guard, to fight against Ukraine. But for every Chechen, pro-Russian Chechen in Ukraine, you've got anti-Russian Chechens fighting on behalf of Ukraine because they want independence. So in Chechnya also borders.
Is anybody other? Anybody other than you keep track? I mean, how can you keep track of all this? Who's where?
Well, it's years ago. I took a trip to the Soviet Union as part of a thing called the People to People Exchange Program, run by the State Department, and we were a computer group that went over first. Of our type, data security people to ever visit the Soviet Union, and that was a year before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I talked to Russians, and they said, "Hey, you know, no, Gorbachev is not going to be around much longer. We've had it. We don't like this system." And I'm shocked because we're being led from one place to another, and they're talking about how great the Soviet Union is, and. When I got back to the States, I had a friend who worked for a government agency, and he says, "Hey, can you come over and brief? I got a little group I'm putting together, and they'd like to hear what you have to say." Well, there were people from the CIA at this meeting, and I'm thinking, "Geez, if they're relying on me for this information, we're in trouble." But I gave one of those overhead projector type briefings and said, "Look, here's what's going to happen." And I said, "It looks like the Soviet Union is in trouble." Now, meanwhile, a lot of other Eastern European countries had already broken with the Soviets. I got some questions from these agency folks, and they were saying, Yeah, well, what do you make of Uzbekistan? Well, that was one of the major constituents of the Soviet Union. But I said the thing you need to focus on are these, what they call these associate Soviet Socialist Republics, ASSRs, embedded in Russia, the Russian portion of the Soviet Union. I said, if they start going for independence, you're going to see something, a major geopolitical shift in on the Eurasian landmass. And
what happened to?
In fact, that happened with Chechnya. They did try to declare independence.
What happened to the guy, Andrew? Who was the dude? He had the big mercenary army over there, and the guy that Putin knocked off in the airplane, he blew up. What happened to all those people? All his big army.
He was executed more or less.
Along with other people on the same plane.
Prigozhin, Wayne?
Yevgeny Prigozhin, I think, was
How many people did he have?
A quick history of him, which is very interesting and important, is he had been a criminal, very tough guy, and then he became a chef, well-connected to the Kremlin, and then he became head of their internet research agency, which whatever one hears, and I actually studied this a lot, as did Wayne, and wrote extensively about it, they did interfere in our 2016 election on behalf of Trump. That's a fact. And Prigozhin at this internet research agency was a big part of it, using social media and along with his allies, including in the West, and interfering, helping create the Brexit vote in Britain and other interference in Western areas and elections in that time period. And then he became head of this kind of private army,
Wagner Group, yeah.
And they were very successful because they were very ruthless. They recruited a lot of almost condemned prisoners. So think of the movie The Dirty Dozen in the U.S.
Okay, I get it.
Convicted killers that, stop at nothing, but instead of a dozen of them, there were, tens of thousands, maybe 20,000, under this guy, Putin's chef, they called him. And he was very successful for a while. And then he got kind of too big for his britches, and he's challenging the regular Russian army generals. And then he led this kind of revolution or march to Moscow. And then partway through it, they said, stop the march, come on up, let's talk. And I'm paraphrasing here, but on his plane to kind of talk things out with the top people in Russia, a very unfortunate accident occurred to the airplane.
And there were regular people on the plane too, right? It was a passenger plane.
It was a business jet.
Okay, a business jet, right.
Yeah, and I think all the people on there, it was very convenient, of course, for Putin because Prigozhin's number two happened to be on the plane, so you didn't have to worry about some guy.
But I mean, what happened to the 20,000 people? Are they in anybody's sight anywhere in this mess?
That's interesting. Some of them were absorbed into the Russian military. Some got safe passage to Belarus, courtesy of their dictator, Alexander Lukashenko. He put them in like special barracks, and it's difficult because I don't think we have very good intelligence in Belarus. But that some of them may have gone back to Russia where they were press ganged into service with the military. But others may still be in Belarus, figuring life is better here than it is over in Russia.
But they never became a part of the Ukraine thing on one side or the other to any stretch.
Yeah, some of them could have wound up there, but because it's like the French Foreign Legion, you know, they're all mercenaries, many of them from other countries too, not just Russia. For example, Wagner, they still had people in Africa fighting in these civil wars on behalf of local dictators. So, some of those guys have become part of a different mercenary group, which is still a Russian one.
The dogs.
And by the way, the Africa thing, I'm glad Wayne brought it up, because it's very significant geopolitically, because there's a whole band of nations that in the last decade or so kind of flipped from being pro-West, pro-US, to pro Russian and kind of more Muslim extremists. And Wagner Group, under Prigozhin, had been supplying these private armies to some of the would-be dictators down there. Many of the would-be dictators became actual dictators that overthrew the pro-Western governments there. And this is a strip almost across Africa, from the Atlantic over to the Horn of Africa, and it's probably about five or six countries, and it's a huge geopolitical loss for the United States. And some of these Wagner groups that you asked about, Chief, what happened to them? Some went back to Africa to stir things up against the United States down there. So these situations are not necessarily just isolated in certain
areas. They all kind of have fingers in each other's pie.
Yes.
Well, how about we go to break here? SPV is up 33, NASDAQ is up 288. We come back. How about you guys tell me how to trade the market here? It's every day I'm like confused a little bit. You know, I'm not so sure anybody isn't, but at least I admit it. We'll be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks and Jocks. Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're back. Welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 30. S&P futures up 281. We've been here pretty much since we came in. NASDAQ might have been up a little more, but it's pretty much hanging in there. Again, NVIDIA's up 13.53. That's the big news last night. On the numbers, it was down, and they came out and said, oh, by the way, we're buying this company for $12 billion, and things are better. Their chairman, I'll just say, is good at that. I mean, he's always got a story. But on the NVIDIA, I'm saying the other one is, well, we had Salesforce hit earnings. It's up 10%. It's up $20. I think it might have been up like $40 at one point. So Salesforce came out with pretty good numbers as well. I mean, it seems like everybody, even your Dollar Generals, those kinds of people, everybody's talking about sales are up, and every single one of them says it's because prices are higher. Well, I don't think that equals necessarily health for the population, but it's health for them, evidently. Over in Europe, we got the DAX up 98.4%, FTSE down 38.4%. CAC Iran, however, down 86. That's a whole 1%. So that's mixed, but kind of to the downside over in Europe, although I'm sure the DAX is a lot bigger than the CAC Iran. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 130.2%, not much there. Hang Seng down 87.3%. Shanghai up 44. That's over 1%. So again, we've got days where the Hang Seng and the mainland are going different directions. Bonds, U.S. 10-year unchanged at 4.67. And I've got, ever since when we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, Bessent's purchase of these bonds, we're at 4.6 in the 10. We were at 4.7. So it's still down a little bit on the rate, but kind of marginally. Oil up 12 cents, 82.85. So 82.35. So it's way less than it was at the 85 the other day. So something must be getting through the strait. It must be getting a little better over there. Natural gas up 4 cents, 288. And we've got gold, which is about a tear, was down a bit yesterday. It's down $1.90 today, 46.51. Silver's up 27 cents, 68.29. Foreign exchange, this is one we're watching on the Japanese side. Japanese yen, 159.42. So, again, after the big, this is by Bessent, he's been doing a lot of the policy stuff lately, Secretary of the Treasury. They drove that from 163 down to 157 and change. Now it's back up nearing this 160 number. So it doesn't look like they have to do it again like right now, but it's not exactly trending the way anybody wants. Bitcoin up 945, 79,037. It's been a huge winter here. Jim, what do you have for us, Traffic Weather Sports?
Well, it is the 27th of August at 7:34. Right now on the inbound east, on the inbound Kennedy, we have 28 minutes. Inbound east is 46. Inbound on the Eisenhower, 50 minutes. And inbound Dan Ryan. So you have traffic today. In weather, right now, Phoenix is 92. And another extreme heat warning. It'll be a high of 114. Here in Chicago, it's currently 68 degrees with a high of 77. And maybe a couple of sprinkles in the afternoon because the wind is going to come off the lake. In sports, Cubs lose, Sox win. Back to you.
Guys, we're going to try and wiggle into the economics here a little bit. I know we have people on the show and a lot of people that are convinced that there's somewhat of a big time plan behind the current administration. And you know what? I really hope they're right. I have real issues with Wall Street Journal. I don't know if they're considered a communist rag now or what. When Bessent did the thing with the 30-year bond or the long term bonds. The deal, according to the Journal, this is part of a way to shove the Bitcoin stuff of the world up and to start using that, like, instead of the, like, dollars. Now, we have people in the administration that are all over these Bitcoin investments. And I don't think these people are straight at all. And then, on the one hand, we have the Fed coming up, everybody's behind, with every nickel that you and I spend someplace. And yet we're pushing something that by most people's, at least some people's thing, is the reason, is the way if you're going to launder money around the world, this is what you do. You would think that if we really, really cared about that, we would be shutting that off, not putting it on. I mean, I just see these inconsistencies, and I just, I don't know what to make of them. I honestly don't. I mean, just even in the area that I sort of deal with. I mean, Andrew, would you care to comment on either side? I mean, I might think, by the way, the money supply came out the other day, and if you take the last 6 months, we're at an annual rate of 7.1% to the upside. Anybody who thinks that these guys are fighting inflation, guess what? I'm going to be a jockey in the fifth race today. You can believe that, too. I mean, we're not even close to the truth here. Am I just being grumpy or what?
Well, we could do, if we had the money for it, a survey and survey people, and we can get 10,000 people and get their opinion, print up the results in 6 months. But here's my quick survey. One, you're in this business. You're the one who charts the rise and fall of different brands of cottage cheese and the trade negotiations, as well as
I did that once. I'm trying never to do it again.
but you know, every day you're monitoring these statistics all over the world. So when you raise questions and suspicions, that to me is worth 5,000 people in a phone Gallup survey. And here's my other survey of two people, which is Paul Krugman, who, you know, he's a very distinguished economist and commentator. And his conclusion is that cryptocurrency is of value for two sets of people, speculators and money launderers with no intrinsic value for anyone else, and everyone else should be highly suspicious. So that's my two-person, I won't call it a Gallup survey, but that's my two-person survey, you and Paul Krugman. And I think at some point, very soon, the burden has to be on people who say, oh, there is value, to say, okay, prove it, and why don't you open your books, and by the way, who's profiting by this? And they say, oh no, but the point of cryptocurrency is you can't open the books. And we say, all right, you've just confessed to the suspicion that it's speculation and money laundering for illegal activities. So,
well, I think actually, you know, some of the other people on the show that know a lot more about crypto, everything that's done in the crypto world, excuse me, you absolutely can trace if you want to. I mean, the feds or the Treasury or somebody, they were able to track down virtually all of the stuff that the guys used for, what was the pipeline shutdown, the big, what was that, a couple years ago, Wayne?
They got
almost all that money back, didn't they? I mean,
the Colonial Pipeline, the ransomware operation against the pipeline. And I got to think that the National Security Agency, which is the premier code-breaking agency in the world, also can do that at relative ease, but they've got the supercomputers up at Fort Meade to be able to do that type
of thing. But will they, and is that power to trace used selectively on certain targets and people and exempting others?
That was my next question. Andrew. When you talk about the Colonial Pipeline, it appears, you know, to me, being, you know, I guess somewhat of a, you know, try not to say I'm a conspiracy guy, but they were all over that. Yet you read anecdotally, you know, listeners send me stuff regarding, you know, some other place that got hacked by somebody and got ransomed out in Bitcoin. Are they going after everybody? I mean, it seems like the law, boy, I hate to bring this up with Andrew because he's a guy that still has respect for it. To me, everything I see is selective. I mean, the politicalness of going after people, anything from local police to state police to the FBI to wherever it is, everything seems politically driven. It's not like we care about somebody like breaking the law. There's no respect for the law. It's whether somebody we don't like is breaking the law. I mean, I know that's being a little sweeping.
I mean, by the way, you use the term conspiracy theory, and I've studied the origins of that, but also the ordinary practice, and we see in a lot of prosecutions, including some of those arising out of, let's say, the immigration prosecutions and pushback on that in both Chicago and Minnesota, that conspiracy is actually one of the most widely used federal crimes there is, because all it means is that two or more people plotted to do something illegally, and it's being tossed around in all kinds of ways that are, I'd say, routine, but actually abusive, where people who may have talked to people who were involved in suspicious or actual crimes, but have no necessarily provable connection, are charged with conspiracy, because it's a very handy charge to just toss around, which is why it's widely used and also subject to abuse. So it has two meanings, one in just ordinary criminal law, where it's widely accepted and used, and the other to denote super mysterious, weird things. And it's useful to keep those two definitions in mind.
Well, it just seems like the law enforcement, and again, this is, I think that this group is doing it about as bad as I've ever seen, but Biden and the people before that, I don't know if you've ever, whatever crimes that have hopefully not affected you guys, everybody that, well, a lot of this one, it's been a long time ago, but back when, all this stuff, when I say all this stuff, when people started using the internet in places to steal money from people, I mean, it happened to us at PTI. Okay, it's a long time ago, and it was reasonable amount of dough, but it was essentially somebody got a hold of somebody's computer and passwords and stuff and took money out of their account, and we didn't catch it. Well, now, of course, that's never going to happen again but every other firm that I know of, be it a bank, another securities firm, somebody got nailed once, at least once, before they tighten things up so much that you got to meet somebody before you get money to them. It's not that bad, but I mean, it's all the new rules about if we ship money out to somebody, it's only going to a certain bank. It's that kind of thing, because all the stuff that has happened is come out of this chicanery of, I'll say, 10 years ago, and me being, as you can only imagine, I'm kind of a terrier dog from the south side. I trace this, and what happened at our place. I went to every single law enforcement place. Every one of them had no interest whatsoever, even though I was given them all the places that the fraud came from. And I finally tracked them all down to some place in Brooklyn where the money ended up. I mean, I did this all myself. I hired people to help me do it. I got no interest, and the thing I got from police, what are you calling us for? Finally, somebody at the Comptroller of the Currency does some of this stuff, and they go, oh, no, if it's not over like 150 grand, we're not chasing it. Fortunately, ours wasn't, and we ended up covering the guy and everything, but the point being, but then one of my clients, they're in the nursing home business, and somehow somebody hacked all this money out of their place. And they told them, oh, if it's less than a million, we don't chase it. So whatever the number was, the story that you got from these people is they don't go after something like that. A guy used to be on the show, Bob Cerrone. You know what happened to those guys? They got just a regular firm. It's not even other people's money. Like we, obviously ours and our, we don't hold people's money, RBC or IBITA. Somebody got into his internal stuff, and they told his his guy in charge of the money, VP of finance or whatever, to send this check out somebody, and sent an email from Bob to this guy, saying it was okay to do it, and the guy sent it internally. I mean, it got so, but anybody you called, I think their bank was actually able to trace it, only because the bank did. But if you get money. Somebody steals money out of your bank account, God help you if you call any of the law enforcement. They don't care. They absolutely don't care. I mean, and I, up and down the line, whenever you see government going after somebody, I just, you know, I just, you know, my sphincter tightens almost because somebody's after somebody. I mean, when we get a new client, one of you guys becomes a client of PTI, we have two guys here to go through your whole records all the way to Interpol. It's not like even if the money's coming from Chase Bank, we can't trust that. We have become law enforcement. So have the banks. So whenever law enforcement gets off their dead ass to do something, I almost think there's some other motive to it. I know I'm a little too far on this one, but I've been involved in it. So talk me down from this, Andrew, please. You're my confessor.
Well, I think in many ways you're right. It happens. I've spent a lot of attention on pro and con on the situations you describe, and one of these days I'll describe one such situation that's coming to a conclusion in a positive way. There are circumstances when you can find the right people in law enforcement who will do the right things, and maybe it's most of them, and yet we're subjected to the aberrations, the man bite dog stuff that gets our attention, and it just puts a burden on not only those trying to do the right thing, like you and your company, but all of the rest of us sorting through layers of passwords on everything that we're trying to do, but also just politically to try to understand what's going on. And at the risk of I'll try to time myself, a 35-second story. Just yesterday, I was talking to Wayne about some YouTube I'd seen of a federal judge being beaten up going through the Charlotte airport and, you know, horrible situation with the guards and everything. And Wayne said, "Oh, I think I've seen that. That's artificial intelligence. That never happened." And I said, "Wait a second. It's an 8-minute story with all these photos." And he said, "Yeah, artificial intelligence, you can create a whole phony thing." He said, "I think I've seen it." And I said, "Why would anyone do that?" And he says, "Well, you know, you might have kids or just people who, like, they set fires and forest fires to watch it burn, but you could also have foreign countries who want to do what Wayne called accelerationists and get the black people all, you know, excited and ready to go to war against the MAGA people by showing a black judge being beaten up at an airport that never happened and use AI." And I thought, "Oh my God, do we have to worry about that?"
Oh yeah, without a doubt we do. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And the Russians are doing this, not just the Russians, but they're the premier intelligence organization that, you know, managed to get the UK to vote against the EU. Now they want to go back in. And our election, it got Trump in it and back in 2016. But, you know, you can go onto YouTube or TikTok and, you know, there's a French presidential election coming up. You can see the same type of video in French done by AI where, you know, it's some Algerian immigrants in France that are doing something or getting something done to them. And it all has the same intent to get the population up in arms and you know, developing into civil unrest and that type of thing. And that suits the Russians in this case just fine. They're not the only ones. Iran has done some of this. Iran, though, seems to like to do these AI videos of Lego people doing things like in a cartoon. And I think they just went after, I guess there was one where they were threatening Barron Trump, which, you know, elicited the response from the U.S. that Iran wanted. "Oh, we're going to You know, they're threatening Barron Trump, the son of the president. Well, are they really, or is this just something to, you know, get the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, we have
supporters riled up.
In real simple stuff, and I'll give you. We are Stocks and Jacks, so you will. We manage a lot of money for people, right? I mean, that's no secret, I hope. We have some people that are in the index program, our protected index program, where we actually have indices, but we also have a lot of people who have individual stocks that want us to manage it the same way, you know, depending on their station in life, whether we protect the value or we don't or whatever. But last night, we've got this NVIDIA mess, or earnings, I won't say mess. And the guy who runs the place to me, he's not my favorite. but so last night, we had sold some calls in the QQQ, right? And we sold, I think, the 7/16s. And, and all of a sudden, you know, there was a good... The QQQs were trading like 7/11 last night. So 5 hours under the strike. And the earnings had come out, and, and the stock's down in NVIDIA. So the Qs are like, they're $5 out of the money after the close. And these things are still 35-cent bid. So my brother Dan says to me, "What do you think?" I go, "Somebody has to know something. This guy's going to come out in some line of BS. And all of a sudden, everybody's convinced it's going to jump enough because you can exercise these things to 7 o'clock. So I go, he goes, "I don't like to pay 35 cents for something 5 hours out of the money." And I go, "Hey, look, we sold them for higher. Let's just take our profit and run. And if we're wrong, you know, I guess, but let's not get screwed by this." Sure enough, this guy comes out with some long story about the future is so bright he's got to wear shades. And the thing goes out at 7/17, and they're worth a buck. I mean, this goes on every day. Now, somebody obviously knew what this guy was going to say and how he was going to pump. People are not that dumb. The market's not that dumb. It's so obvious to everybody, you know, and yet somebody must have had. Remember Regulation FD? Is that up somebody's behind somewhere and it'll never be pulled out again? Were fair disclosure to everybody. The guy must have leaked what he was going to say to some people. Who the hell would have a 35-cent bid for a call at 10 minutes after 3 with the market closed, essentially, and the earnings are already out? And yet, there they were. And guess what? They went out a buck. Isn't that special?
Well, we know that the SEC is doing such a wonderful job at regulating things days. Regulation, there are no regulations anymore.
Well, for some people.
Yeah.
But
well,
other people, there's all kinds of them.
Yeah. I don't know. It's by the way, I know we didn't touch on this Canadian trade situation, but
might have you guys back before next Thursday, if you don't mind, just to talk about that for a few minutes, because it's evolving, so we might be too early to talk about it. But
you know that we're going to be paying more for toilet paper.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And because even though the U.S. says but we make toilet paper in the U.S., it's the cellulose from the Canadian pulp that's used to make American toilet paper. So.
I know. I'm going out to Costco this weekend and buying 50 rolls. Isn't that what we used to, every time? What else? What other crisis did we went on?
Well, you got a pickup truck, so you can haul quite a bit of it, right?
I remember my mom was still alive, and there was a I don't know what crisis this was, and she goes, "Let me get this straight. The toilet paper is all off the shelf, and they got a sale on Kleenex." isn't it sort of the same? Actually, it's not quite the same thing, but in terms of the plumbing, it's not the same thing. But
or the use of paper towels. We once got a directive from our office where I live. It said, "Please don't be flushing paper towels apparently it messes up some sort of thing that
it doesn't degrade like toilet paper." Every plumber will tell you there's only three things to go in the toilet. You know the three.
One, two. Number one, number two, right.
And then the toilet paper. Two, that's right. It. Anyway, the Canadian thing. But now, you know, the people from the right now are convinced that at Carney because there was some money laundering through Britain when he was the head of the Bank of England, that he's like this big crook and can't be trusted. I'm going to say that the amount of money laundering that goes through our country is 10 times what it does. It's from, maybe it's 100 times what goes through Britain. What do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, Carney was not only the head of the Bank of England, he was head of the Bank of Canada. He's probably the most qualified person to be prime minister in a time like this. This is unprecedented. I thought it was also interesting. What Trump's doing to Canada has actually united Canada in a way that they've never been united before. The Quebec separatists have now put a moratorium on any other referendums for independence until Trump is out of office. So he's uniting the country.
Well, my guys, I mean, the people, I mean, it's because I disagree with them on some of the political stuff. They're good, you know, they know they're good guys. They're like you, they're just kind of on the, you know, some of the...
Canadians.
Okay,
great people.
So I'm talking about a guy like Carney, okay, because you sent me some stuff about Besant the other day. A guy like Carney, let's say he's very talented. How much, even if the guy is, you know, Solomon, for God's sake, how much crap in those kinds of positions does he have to look the other way on? You can't fight every battle. I mean, what, in other words, there has to be, my guys are not wrong, 100%. There has to be some kind of trail of, I'll use the term, crap associated with Carney that the three of us might say, well, here's one you should have looked into, and he didn't, and here's another one you should have looked into, or this shouldn't have happened on your watch. Yeah. I'll bet we could find that with him or any other person. How much of this comes down like to judgment to where, I don't think, I mean, if the three of us became head of the Fed and the Treasury tomorrow, I don't think in 4 years we could grab every single knave was money laundering, could we? What kind of a job is that?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that money laundering went on his watch, I guess, how much of an indictment is that? Did he make it worse? Did he make it better? I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I'm not telling my guys that they're wrong by telling me this, because I'm sure they're right. That stuff went on when he was the head of the person in Britain. Now, the question is, at what level? You know, if you don't like the guy, it's the wrong level. If you like the guy, you say it's an okay level. Well, that's not really the way to do it, is it? I mean, I don't think. I don't want any of that stuff to happen, but I also know that it sort of does. I mean, fix me here, Andrew.
Well, everybody who gets to the top has something. And one of the great American novels, All the King's Men, published, I think, in the 30s, or, well, maybe it was after, but it was basically based on Huey Long, who was in the 30s. And the plot line, briefly, was a reporter was asked by a boss to get the dirt on the most upstanding judge in Louisiana. And the reporter says, no, I've known him my whole life. He's totally honest. And the boss says, there's always something, find it. And the key quote is, it took me 6 months, but I found it. There's always something. And the question is what to make of it, given the proportion and the stakes and what else is going on. So I heard some of your discussions earlier in the week. They were fascinating, with some of the expert guests that you're referencing. Basically, if you like Trump and you don't like what Canada's reaction is, you can make a lot out of what happened with the Bank of England, or you can look at the current situation, which is what I think you're trying to do. And we're out of time.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I like to look at the current situation, and I really don't know. That's what I got you guys for, to tell me the history of all this stuff, because I don't know it. I guess I don't care about the history of the guy at NVIDIA, but unless if he passed it out to people yesterday, which he shouldn't have. I don't mean whether he's a good guy or bad guy 6 months from now, really doesn't help me, does it? I mean, you know, we're supposed to have laws, full disclosure. Did other people get news before other people? And if so, is anybody watching it? And I think the answer is no on the last part. But just anyway, guys, what's going on for the weekend? What's the weather like where you guys are?
We're in the down here in the swampy, muggy state. It'll be like this for at least another month here in Florida.
Well, you've got wind shear, so you got no hurricanes, I hear.
That's true. It's been very quiet out there, fortunately.
What's it like in Washington, Andrew?
Not too bad. In fact, a friend of mine from Vermont saying, this is crazy. It's like Vermont weather here in August in Washington. So we'll take it with gratitude and sympathy for other parts of the country that don't have it quite this way.
Well, Indiana got all their stuff from FEMA. Trump still won't declare this disaster in Illinois. Unbelievable. All right, guys. Jim, thank you. S&P futures up 24, NASDAQ futures up 250. We're still up pretty good. Not quite as much as we were earlier, but we're still up. NVIDIA's still up 1260, and we have Salesforce up 21. It was up more than that, but they're still both, they're hanging in there. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.